Well, today I'm delighted to bring you the history of the Cooks River, which drains into Botany Bay. And what's so notable about the book that has prompted us, I think, is that it sees the river's history as an emblem of general attitudes to our waterways post the industrial age, as it particular ranged from a near-death experience to, well, we'll hear how our guest will answer that question. Here's a sample of the work of the man I'll introduce you to, who happily admits to having developed an obsession with the river. In the beginning, he writes, there was the river, before the beach, before the drain, before the dredging, before the dams, before numerous other actions to alter the stream. It came before us. Its history began in geological time. Then came the dreaming and the long Aboriginal occupation, and then colonial time, after an English explorer named James Cook sailed the HMS Endeavour in April 1770. Well, the writer of those very evocative sentences is Emeritus Professor of History at the University of New South Wales and the author of River Dreams, Ian Tyrrell, and he joins us now in the studio. Good morning, Ian.
Thank you for inviting me, Geraldine.
You certainly let your imagination run. Let's just answer that first question first. What is the river now?
Well, it's a place of recreation. It's actually quite a ribbon of green vegetation that runs through the southeastern to southwestern suburbs of Sydney, from Botany Bay up to around Graff Park at Yagoona. It's a cycleway. It's a series of football fields and various other things. It's also got restored bushland, and it has some remnant bushland in Woolleye Creek, which is a tributary of the Cooks River. And in the book, I really look at the entire valley.
The point is, it's a long way from a near-death experience, isn't it?
It is today. It's making its way back. It would take a long time to get over the pollution of the 1970s. People hope that they'll be able to swim in the river again, as they did as late as the 1940s. I think this is unlikely for quite a few years. But as long as they don't dredge it, the worst of the pollution won't come up from the mud below.
So you nearly called... So the book is called River Dreams, but you nearly called it something else, didn't you?
I had lots of titles in mind. Cook's River, An Unnatural History, which is to refer to the fact that it has so many things done to it that it's been kind of manufactured. But I would argue that this happens to virtually all of our rivers in one way or another and to some degree. The only thing about the Cook's River, it's had a lot of them done, practically everything that you could do to a river except actually pave it right over and, you know, end its existence, has actually been done. I mean, the banks and the bottom and places have been paved. There's steel piling. There's dredging galore gone on. A dam and a weir. And so on and so forth. There's just a huge number of things that have been done to the river over the course of the last 200 years.
The title I liked is you nearly called it The River That Died of Shame.
Well, that's what they used to say in the 1980s and 1990s because the pollution was so bad. I mean, the cyanide, potassium cyanide spill, which killed so many fish that it took 15 tons of fish had to be removed and thousands of birds in 1973.
We've put that picture on our website. Yeah, it's devastating.
And it's not the only case of a cyanide
spill. Front page of the Sun.
Plus oil coming from the State Rail Authority marshalling yards at Enfield, and so on and so forth. But almost everything, as I say elsewhere in the book, it's not just everything but the kitchen sink, it's everything and the kitchen sink has been thrown into that river. There's not a single thing, I think. Telephone booths have been found in it, cars and so on.
I shouldn't laugh.
But plastic, of course, is the problem today, or at least the most visible problem, and it that affects the ecology too. Very badly, and it affects our oceans because that ends up in Botany Bay and then out to sea.
Not that you're emotional about this. Look, you've walked the river.
Yes.
Why, which I want to hear more about, why was it called the Cooks River? And also, Governor Phillip had a whole lot of very ambivalent attitudes to it, didn't he?
Well, he didn't think that it was what Cook had said. Cook said that it was a fine stream surrounded by fine meadows and it was a suitable place for a convict settlement. But when Phillip arrived, he arrived in a very different season, possibly affected by an El Nino. But it was certainly a dry a dry period in which he arrived in January of 1788. And so he decided to go upstream to where there was a harbour, which turned out to be the site of settlement. And of course, that then became the focus of everything. So the Cook's River became the sort of other where bad things were done to it thereafter. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a model,
can I interrupt you, because you prompt so many things in this book. Mm. It wasn't the model of a European river, was it?
No, that's right. I mean, its flow was too episodic. It was basically a lot of marshland, partly a tidal watercourse with lots and lots of mangroves on it, as it does have today, but they've all regrown. So it wasn't a river which was like the Thames didn't have the sorts of things going for it that the mighty rivers of Europe or North America have going for them. But then there are rivers like this in North America as well. There are rivers mm-hmm. like this in Africa as well. It's not, again, that's not completely unique, but it was something that confounded people when in the early days because they wanted to turn it into a source of fresh water for the colony. And that's why they built the dam. And from the dam, there flowed a lot of problems.
What was it like before European settlement?
Well, it was, as far as we know, it was very swampy. Watkin Tench gives a wonderful account of trying to chase Pemulwuy through that landscape, up and down creeks and valleys, and of course couldn't catch him. So it was heavily vegetated, but the Aboriginal people made great use of it, particularly for shellfish and for fish. And so they used all of the resources, but they did so in a what we would say today would be a fairly sustainable way. I wouldn't call it a paradise because I think that evokes the wrong kind of image. Mm. It was a managed landscape. We know that Aboriginal people managed our landscape. It had been altered, but it wasn't altered to the same extent that it was to be altered afterwards. I mean, the Aboriginal people didn't put an airport on top of it reroute it.
That's what's so interesting about your book, and I think this sort of new genre that's emerging, is that you look at it as an emblem, if I'm using that word, yeah. of post-industrial attitudes to waterways. And, yes. You know, we were discussing Korea earlier, and of course in Seoul, they have reconstructed a river right through the middle of Seoul, which was completely concreted over. Mm. It's amazing to see. Yeah. Yeah. And they decided to bring it back. So this is not just here.
No, it's not. The only thing that's unique, and I've looked at a lot of those rivers in the course of my travels and in the course of my research, and so that's why I'm very careful to say this is not an unusual thing. It's not even the accumulation of things that have been done to the river. The only thing that's truly unique about this river is the sense of place that was developed about it, that was developed over a period of time by people agitating to improve it at first, and then to remediate some of the damage that had been done before. And there's virtually a continuous story of this through from about 1908 through to today. So people in the valley, at least environmentally oriented people, are aware of the Cook's River Valley Association and its predecessor, the Cook's River Improvement League, and what a long agitation there has been over it. And it's also there at present in literature as well.
Is it?
Oh, yes, it is, yeah. Well, Michelle de Cresta refers to the river quite a bit in her novels, for example. She's also got a story, a ghost story, which deals with a particular incident on the river.
But it even touches our whole multicultural past, doesn't it? Because tell us about the Chinese market gardens and what that stirred up.
Well, the Chinese market gardens were very, very extensive on the lower river and middle river sections. They were a major way in which the landscape was changed. And you can still see the imprint of those. And you can actually still visit a couple of the market gardens at Muddy Creek. They're very threatened, of course. But they came in the 1870s and they were quite a dominant feature. They were both despised and kind of approved of, or at least admired for what they did. They turned the lower river into a set of farms. they were very good at market gardening, and European farmers had to either copy them or they had to actually employ them, which is what they frequently did. So there was a very, very strong Chinese association with the Lower River. But again, I'm not saying that's unique. You find Chinese market gardens all over the colony. Mm. It's just a particular concentration of them. And I talk about this as the creation of a kind of racial landscape where some people looked down on these Chinese. So they looked at the smell of the river, they looked at the Chinese, and they associated the two.
Extraordinary.
I talk about the olfactory landscape.
So when would you say that this whole notion of, well, obviously there's been various iterations of it, but when was the really circuit-breaking moment when people start to say, we've got to improve this, this has gone beyond the pale?
I think the 1970s, the Whitlam government gave some money for a Cook's River landscape study, the Cook's River Valley landscape study, which involved Milo Dunphy, a very prominent environmentalist of the time. And the sort of green image of the valley began to inspire people about that time. But it was also the time that other rivers began to be renovated, as I put it in the book, or remediated
around the world.
So, the things that are done to the Cook River Valley in recent years in order to remediate damage are very, very similar to those that have been done in a lot of other rivers.
I wonder, this is just a speculation, I wonder if that is the sort of the result of recovering from the whole World War II period when, you know, there was sort of so much was under threat, the industrial world was thrown at it, and then everybody eventually recovered from that and started looking at the environment around them.
Could be, but I don't really think so. I think it's the intensification of industrialization, particularly in the case of the Cook's River in the valley. There actually wasn't all that much heavy industry in the valley before World War II. Most of it is a product of World War II and thereafter. So there is more and more being dumped in. There were good reasons to remediate the damage. Very good reasons. But that connected with the fact that the same kind of thing was happening in other rivers around the world, particularly in the United States.
So what's its key challenge now?
Its key challenge now is really the apartment boom, the building of more and more apartments, which means that there are going to be more people in the valley. There's more burden upon the parkland, which is very, very limited in extent given the increase in population, and also more pollution in the form of plastic and other things that are left in parks. Unless we can improve our education of people in terms of recycling this material beyond what we do now and providing recycling facilities, then that is a bad thing for the valley. That would probably be the single most. And the competing interests that there are over what to do with that parkland, you know, between organised recreation and passive recreation. And very much councils are interested in organised recreation rather than the passive recreation.
Very interesting, Ian Tyrrell. Thank you for walking the river and becoming so absorbed in it. And congratulations on River Dreams.
Well, thank you very much, Geraldine.
Ian Tyrrell is Emeritus Professor of History at UNSW. And his book, River Dreams, has been published by UNSW Press.